Cassette 2, Side 2.
An endless road. Letting oneself be pushed by the mob, letting oneself be dragged along by a blind destiny. When the SS became tired, they were changed, but no one changed us. Our limbs numb with cold, despite the running, our throats parched, famished, breathless. On we went. We were masters of nature, masters of the world. We had forgotten everything, death, fatigue, our natural needs. Stronger than cold or hunger, stronger than the shots and the desire to die, condemned and wandering, mere numbers, we were the only men on earth. At last, the morning star appeared in the gray sky. A trail of indeterminate light showed on the horizon. We were exhausted. We were without strength, without illusions. The commandant announced that we had already covered 42 miles since we left. It was a long time since we had passed beyond the limits of fatigue. Our legs were moving mechanically, in spite of us, without us. We went through a deserted village. Not a living soul, not the bark of a dog. Houses with gaping windows. A few slipped out of the ranks to try and hide in some deserted building. Still 1 hour's marching more, and at last came the order to rest. We sank down as one man in the snow. My father shook me. "Not here. Get up. A little farther on, there's a shed over there. Come on." I had neither the will nor the strength to get up. Nevertheless, I obeyed. It was not a shed, but a brick factory with a caved-in roof, broken windows, walls filthy with soot. It was not easy to get in. Hundreds of prisoners were crowding at the door. We at last succeeded in getting inside. There, too, the snow was thick. I let myself sink down. It was only then that I really felt my weariness. The snow was like a carpet, very gentle, very warm. I fell asleep. I do not know how long I slept. A few moments or an hour. When I woke up, a frozen hand was patting my cheeks. I forced myself to open my eyes. It was my father. How old he had grown since the night before. His body was completely twisted, shriveled up into itself. His eyes were petrified, his lips withered, decayed. Everything about him bore witness to extreme exhaustion. His voice was damp with tears and snow. "Don't let yourself be overcome by sleep, Eliezer. It's dangerous to fall asleep in the snow. You might sleep for good. Come on, come on. Get up." Get up? How could I? How could I get myself out of this fluffy bed? I could hear what my father said, but it seemed empty of meaning, as though he had told me to lift up the whole building in my arms. "Come on, son, come on." I got up, gritting my teeth. Supporting me with his arm, he led me outside. It was far from easy. It was as difficult to go out as to get in. Under our feet were men crushed, trampled underfoot, dying. No one paid any attention. We were outside. The icy wind stung my face. I bit my lips continually to prevent them from freezing. Around me, everything was dancing a dance of death. It made my head reel. I was walking in a cemetery among stiffened corpses, logs of wood. Not a cry of distress, not a groan. Nothing but a mass agony, in silence. No one asked anyone else for help. You died because you had to die. There was no fuss. In every stiffened corpse I saw myself. And soon I should not even see them. I should be one of them, a matter of hours. "Come on, Father, let's go back to the shed." He did not answer. He was not looking at the dead. "Come on, Father, it's better over there. We can lie down a bit, one after the other. I'll watch over you, and then you can watch over me. We won't let each other fall asleep. We'll look after each other." He agreed. Trampling over living bodies and corpses, we managed to re-enter the shed. Here, we let ourselves sink down. "Don't be afraid, son. Sleep. You can sleep. I look after you myself. Now, you first, father. Go to sleep. He refused. I lay down and tried to force myself to sleep, to doze a little, but in vain. God knows what I would not have given for a few moments of sleep. But deep down, I felt that to sleep would mean to die. And something within me revolted against this death. All round me, death was moving in, silently, without violence. It would seize upon some sleeping being, enter into him, and consume him bit by bit. Next to me there was someone trying to wake up his neighbor, his brother, perhaps, or a friend. In vain. Discouraged in the attempt, the man lay down in his turn next to the corpse and slept too. Who was there to wake him up? Stretching out an arm, I touched him. Wake up, you mustn't sleep here. He half opened his eyes. No advice, he said in a faint voice. I'm tired. Leave me alone. Leave me. My father, too, was gently dozing. I could not see his eyes. His cap had fallen over his face. Wake up, I whispered in his ear. He started up. He sat up and looked round him, bewildered, stupefied, a bereaved stare. He stared all round him in a circle as though he had suddenly decided to draw up an inventory of his universe, to find out exactly where he was, in what place, and why. Then he smiled. I shall always remember that smile. From which world did it come? The snow continued to fall in thick flakes over the corpses. The door of the shed opened. An old man appeared, his mustache covered with frost, his lips blue with cold. It was Rabbi Eliyahu, the rabbi of a small Polish community. He was a very good man, well-loved by everyone in the camp, even by the kapos and the heads of the blocks. Despite the trials and privations, his face still shone with his inner purity. He was the only rabbi who was always addressed as rabbi at Buna. He was like one of the old prophets, always in the midst of his people to comfort them. And strangely, his words of comfort never provoked rebellion. They really brought peace. He came into the shed, and his eyes, brighter than ever, seemed to be looking for someone. Perhaps someone has seen my son somewhere? He had lost his son in the crowd. He had looked in vain among the dying. Then he had scratched up the snow to find his corpse without result. For 3 years they had stuck together, always near each other, for suffering, for blows, for the ration of bread, for prayer. 3 years from camp to camp, from selection to selection. And now, when the end seemed near, fate had separated them. Finding himself near me, Rabbi Eliyahu whispered, "It happened on the road. We lost sight of one another during the journey. I had stayed a little to the rear of the column. I hadn't any strength left for running, and my son didn't notice. That's all I know. Where has he disappeared? Where can I find him? Perhaps you've seen him somewhere?" "No, Rabbi Eliyahu, I haven't seen him." He left then as he had come, like a wind-swept shadow. He had already passed through the door when I suddenly remembered seeing his son running by my side. I had forgotten that, and I didn't tell Rabbi Eliyahu. Then I remembered something else. His son had seen him losing ground, limping, staggering back to the rear of the column. He had seen him. And he had continued to run on in front, letting the distance between them grow greater. A terrible thought loomed up in my mind. He had wanted to get rid of his father. He had felt that his father was growing weak. He had believed that the end was near and had sought this separation in order to get rid of the burden, to free himself from an encumbrance which could lessen his own chances of survival. I had done well to forget that. And I was glad that Rabbi Eliyahu should continue to look for his beloved son. And in spite of myself, a prayer rose in my heart to that God in whom I no longer believed. My God, Lord of the universe, give me strength never to do what Rabbi Eliyahu's son has done. Shouts rose outside in the yard, where darkness had fallen. The SS ordered the ranks to form up. The march began again. The dead stayed in the yard under the snow like faithful guards assassinated without burial. No one had said the prayer for the dead over them. Sons abandoned their father's remains without a tear. On the way it snowed endlessly. We were marching more slowly. The guards themselves seemed tired. My wounded foot no longer hurt me. It must have been completely frozen. The foot was lost to me. It had detached itself from my body like the wheel of a car. Too bad. I should have to resign myself. I could live with only one leg. The main thing was not to think about it. Above all, not at this moment. Leave thoughts for later. Our march had lost all semblance of discipline. We went as we wanted, as we could. We heard no more shots. Our guards must have been tired. But death scarcely needed any help from them. The cold was conscientiously doing its work. At every step, someone fell and suffered no more. From time to time, SS officers on motorcycles would go down the length of the column to try and shake us out of our growing apathy. Keep going, we are getting there. Courage, only a few more hours. We are reaching Gleiwitz. These words of encouragement, even though they came from the mouths of our assassins, did us a great deal of good. No one wanted to give up now, just before the end, so near to the goal. Our eyes searched the horizon for the barbed wire of Gleiwitz. Our only desire was to reach it as quickly as possible. The night had now set in. The snow had ceased to fall. We walked for several more hours before arriving. We did not notice the camp until we were just in front of the gate. Some capos rapidly installed us in the barracks. We pushed and jostled one another as if this were the supreme refuge, the gateway to life. We walked over pain-racked bodies. We trod on wounded faces. No cries, a few groans. My father and I were ourselves thrown to the ground by this rolling tide. Beneath our feet, someone let out a rattling cry. You're crushing me! Mercy! A voice that was not unknown to me. You're crushing me! Mercy! Mercy! The same faint voice, the same rattle, heard somewhere before. That voice had spoken to me one day. Where? When? Years ago? No, it could only have been at the camp. Mercy! I felt that I was crushing him. I was stopping his breath. I wanted to get up. I struggled to disengage myself so that he could breathe. But I was crushed myself beneath the weight of other bodies. I could hardly breathe. I dug my nails into unknown faces. I was biting all round me in order to get air. No one cried out. Suddenly I remembered. Yuliak, the boy from Warsaw who played the violin in the band at Buna. Yuliak, is it you? Eliezer, the 25 strokes of the whip. Yes, I remember. He was silent. A long moment elapsed. Yuliak, can you hear me, Yuliak?
Yes,
he said in a feeble voice. What do you want? He was not dead. How do you feel, Yuliak? I asked, less to know the answer than to hear that he could speak, that he was alive.
All right, Eliezer, I'm getting on all right, hardly any air. Worn out, my feet are swollen. It's good to rest, but my violin...
I thought he had gone out of his mind. What use was the violin here?
What, your violin? He gasped. I'm afraid that they'll break my violin. I've brought it with me.
I could not answer him. Someone was lying full length on top of me, covering my face. I was unable to breathe. Through either mouth or nose, sweat beaded my brow, ran down my spine. This was the end of the road, a silent death, suffocation. No way of crying out, of calling for help. I tried to get rid of my invisible assassin. My whole will to live was centered in my nails. I scratched. I battled for a mouthful of air. I tore at decaying flesh, which did not respond. I could not free myself from this mass weighing down my chest. Was it a dead man I was struggling against? Who knows?
I shall never know. All I can say is that I won. I succeeded in digging a hole through this wall of dying people. A little hole through which I could drink in a small quantity of air. "Father, how are you?" I asked, as soon as I could utter a word. I knew he could not be far from me.
"Well,"
answered a distant voice, which seemed to come from another world. I tried to sleep. He tried to sleep. Was he right or wrong? Could one sleep here? Was it not dangerous to allow your vigilance to fail even for a moment, when at any minute death could pounce upon you? I was thinking of this when I heard the sound of a violin. The sound of a violin in this dark shed where the dead were heaped on the living. What madman could be playing the violin here at the brink of his own grave? Or was it really an hallucination? It must have been Ulyak. He played a fragment from Beethoven's concerto. I had never heard sounds so pure in such a silence. How had he managed to free himself, to draw his body from under mine without my being aware of it? It was pitch dark. I could hear only the violin, and it was as though Ulyak's soul were the bow. He was playing his life. The whole of his life was gliding on the strings, his lost hopes, his charred past, his extinguished future. He played as he would never play again. I shall never forget Ulyak. How could I forget that concert, given to an audience of dying and dead men? To this day, whenever I hear Beethoven played, my eyes close, and out of the dark rises the sad, pale face of my Polish friend, as he said farewell on his violin to an audience of dying men. I do not know for how long he played. I was overcome by sleep. When I awoke in the daylight, I could see Ulyak opposite me, slumped over, dead. Near him lay his violin, smashed, trampled. A strange, overwhelming little corpse. We stayed at Gleiwitz for 3 days. 3 days without food or drink. We were not allowed to leave the barracks. SS men guarded the door. I was hungry and thirsty. I must have been very dirty and exhausted, to judge from the appearance of the others. The bread we had brought from Buna had long since been devoured, and who knew when we would be given another ration. The front was following us. We could hear new gunshots again, very close, but we had neither the strength nor the courage to believe that the Nazis would not have time to evacuate us and that the Russians would soon be here. We heard that we were going to be deported into the center of Germany. On the third day, at dawn, we were driven out of the barracks. We all threw blankets over our shoulders like prayer shawls. We were directed toward a gate which divided the camp into two. A group of SS officers were standing there. A rumor ran through our ranks. A selection. The SS officers did the selecting. The weak to the left, those who could walk well to the right. My father was sent to the left. I ran after him. An SS officer shouted at my back, "Come back here!" I slipped in among the others. Several SS rushed to bring me back, creating such confusion that many of the people from the left were able to come back to the right, and among them, my father and myself. However, there were some shots, and some dead. We were all made to leave the camp. After half an hour's marching, we arrived right in the middle of a field divided by rails. We had to wait for the train to arrive. The snow fell thickly. We were forbidden to sit down or even to move. The snow began to form a thick layer over our blankets. They brought us bread, the usual ration. We threw ourselves upon it. Someone had the idea of appeasing his thirst by eating the snow. Soon the others were imitating him. As we were not allowed to bend down, everyone took out his spoon and ate the accumulated snow off his neighbor's back. A mouthful of bread and a spoonful of snow. The SS who were watching
laughed at this spectacle. Hours went by. Our eyes grew weary of scouring the horizon for the liberating train. It did not arrive until much later in the evening, an infinitely long train composed of cattle wagons, with no roofs. The SS pushed us in, 100 to a carriage, we were so thin. Our embarkation completed, the convoy set out. Pressed up against the others in an effort to keep out the cold, head empty and heavy at the same time, brain a whirlpool of decaying memories. Indifference deadened the spirit. Here or elsewhere, what difference did it make to die today or tomorrow or later? The night was long and never-ending. When at last a gray glimmer of light appeared on the horizon, it revealed a tangle of human shapes, heads sunk upon shoulders, crouched, piled one on top of the other, like a field of dust-covered tombstones in the first light of the dawn. I tried to distinguish those who were still alive from those who had gone, but there was no difference. My gaze was held for a long time by one who lay with his eyes open, staring into the void. His livid face was covered with a layer of frost and snow. My father was huddled near me, wrapped in his blanket, his shoulders covered with snow. And was he dead too? I called him. No answer. I would have cried out if I could have done so. He did not move. My mind was invaded suddenly by this realization. There was no more reason to live. No more reason to struggle. The train stopped in the middle of a deserted field. The suddenness of the halt woke some of those who were asleep. They straightened themselves up, throwing startled looks around them. Outside, the SS went by, shouting, "Throw out all the dead! All corpses outside!" The living rejoiced. There would be more room. Volunteers set to work. They felt those who were still crouching. "Here's one, take him!" They undressed him, the survivors avidly sharing out his clothes. Then two grave diggers took him, one by the head and one by the feet, and threw him out of the wagon, like a sack of flour. From all directions came cries, "Come on, here's one, this man next to me, he doesn't move." I woke from my apathy just at the moment when two men came up to my father. I threw myself on top of his body. He was cold. I slapped him. I rubbed his hands, crying, "Father, father, wake up. They're trying to throw you out of the carriage." His body remained inert. The two gravediggers seized me by the collar. "Leave him. You can see perfectly well that he's dead." "No," I cried. "He isn't dead. Not yet." I set to work to slap him as hard as I could. After a moment, my father's eyelids moved slightly over his glazed eyes. He was breathing, weakly. "You see?" I cried. The two men moved away. 20 bodies were thrown out of our wagon. Then the train resumed its journey, leaving behind it a few hundred naked dead, deprived of burial in the deep snow of a field in Poland. We were given no food. We lived on snow. It took the place of bread. The days were like nights, and the nights left the dregs of their darkness in our souls. The train was traveling slowly, often stopping for several hours and then setting off again. It never ceased snowing. All through these days and nights we stayed crouching, one on top of the other, never speaking a word. We were no more than frozen bodies. Our eyes closed. We waited merely for the next stop so that we could unload our dead. 10 days, 10 nights of traveling. Sometimes we would pass through German townships, very early in the morning, usually. The workmen were going to work. They stopped and stared after us, but otherwise showed no surprise. One day when we had stopped, a workman took a piece of bread out of his bag and threw it into a wagon. There was a stampede. Dozens of starving men fought each other to the death for a few crumbs. The German workmen took a lively interest in this spectacle. Some years later, I watched the same kind of scene at Aden. The passengers on our boat were amusing themselves by throwing coins to the natives who were diving in to get them. An attractive, aristocratic Parisienne was deriving special pleasure from the game. I suddenly noticed that two children were engaged in a death struggle, trying to strangle each other. I turned to the lady. "Please," I begged, "don't throw any more money in." "Why not?" she said. "I like to give charity." In the wagon where the bread had fallen, a real battle had broken out. Men threw themselves on top of each other, stamping on each other, tearing at each other, biting each other. Wild beasts of prey, with animal hatred in their eyes, an extraordinary vitality had seized them, sharpening their teeth and nails. A crowd of workmen and curious spectators had collected along the train. They had probably never seen a train with such a cargo. Soon, nearly everywhere, pieces of bread were being dropped into the wagons. The audience stared at these skeletons of men fighting one another to the death for a mouthful. A piece fell into our wagon. I decided that I would not move. Anyway, I knew that I would never have the strength to fight with a dozen savage men. Not far away, I noticed an old man dragging himself along on all fours. He was trying to disengage himself from the struggle. He held one hand to his heart. I thought at first he had received a blow in the chest. Then I understood. He had a bit of bread under his shirt. With remarkable speed, he drew it out and put it to his mouth. His eyes gleamed. A smile, like a grimace, lit up his dead face, and was immediately extinguished. A shadow had just loomed up near him. The shadow threw itself upon him, felled to the ground, stunned with blows. The old man cried, "Mayor, Mayor, my boy, don't you recognize me? I'm your father. You're hurting me. You're killing your father. I've got some bread for you, too, for you, too." He collapsed. His fist was still clenched around a small piece. He tried to carry it to his mouth, but the other one threw himself upon him and snatched it. The old man again whispered something, let out a rattle, and died amid the general indifference. His son searched him, took the bread, and began to devour it. He was not able to get very far. Two men had seen and hurled themselves upon him. Others joined in. When they withdrew, next to me were two corpses, side by side, the father and the son. I was 15 years old. In our wagon, there was a friend of my father's called Mayor Katz. He had worked as a gardener at Buna and used to bring us a few green vegetables occasionally. Being less undernourished than the rest of us, he had stood up to imprisonment better. Because he was relatively more vigorous, he had been put in charge of the wagon. On the third night of our journey, I woke up suddenly and felt two hands on my throat trying to strangle me. I just had the time to shout, "Father!" Nothing but this word. I felt myself suffocating. But my father had woken up and seized my attacker. Too weak to overcome him, he had the idea of calling Mayor Katz. "Come here, come quickly, there's someone strangling my son." A few moments later, I was free. I still do not know why the man wanted to strangle me. After a few days, Mayor Katz spoke to my father. "Shlomo, I'm getting weak. I'm losing my strength. I can't hold on." "Don't let yourself go under," my father said, trying to encourage him. "You must resist. Don't lose faith in yourself." But Mayor Katz groaned heavily in reply. "I can't go on any longer, Shlomo. What can I do? I can't carry on." My father took his arm, and Mayor Katz, the strong man, the most robust of us all, wept. His son had been taken from him at the time of the first selection, but it was now that he wept. It was now that he cracked up. He was finished, at the end of his tether. On the last day of our journey, a terrible wind arose. It snowed without ceasing. We felt that the end was near, the real end. We could never hold out in this icy wind, in these gusts. Someone got up and shouted, "We mustn't stay sitting down at a time like this. We shall freeze to death. Let's all get up and move a bit." We all got up. We held our damp blankets more tightly around us, and we forced ourselves to move a few steps to turn around where we were. Suddenly, a cry rose up from the wagon, the cry of a wounded animal. Someone had just died. Others, feeling that they too were about to die, imitated his cry. And their cries seemed to come from beyond the grave. Soon everyone was crying out, wailing, groaning, cries of distress hurled into the wind and the snow. The contagion spread to the other carriages. Hundreds of cries rose up simultaneously, not knowing against whom we cried, not knowing why. The death rattle of a whole convoy who felt the end upon them. We were all going to die here. All limits had been passed. No one had any strength left. And again the night would be long. Mayor Katz groaned, "Why don't they shoot us all right away?" That same evening, we reached our destination. It was late at night. The guards came to unload us. The dead were abandoned in the train. Only those who could still stand were able to get out. Mayor Katz stayed in the train. The last day had been the most murderous. 100 of us had got into the wagon. 12 of us got out. Among them, my father and I. We had arrived at Buchenwald. At the gate of the camp, SS officers were waiting for us. They counted us. Then we were directed to the assembly place. Orders were given us through loudspeakers. "Form fives. Form groups of 100. 5 paces forward." I held onto my father's hand, the old familiar fear not to lose him. Right next to us, the high chimney of the crematory oven rose up. It no longer made any impression on us. It scarcely attracted our attention. An established inmate of Buchenwald told us that we should have a shower and then we could go into the blocks. The idea of having a hot bath fascinated me. My father was silent. He was breathing heavily beside me. "Father," I said, "only another moment more. Soon we can lie down in a bed. You can rest." He did not answer. I was so exhausted myself that his silence left me indifferent. My only wish was to take a bath as quickly as possible and lie down in a bed. But it was not easy to reach the showers. Hundreds of prisoners were crowding there. The guards were unable to keep any order. They struck out right and left with no apparent result. Others, without the strength to push or even to stand up, had sat down in the snow. My father wanted to do the same. He groaned, "I can't go on. This is the end. I'm going to die here." He dragged me toward a hillock of snow from which emerged human shapes and ragged pieces of blanket. "Leave me," he said to me. "I can't go on. Have mercy on me. I'll wait here until we can get into the baths. You can come and find me." I could have wept with rage. Having lived through so much, suffered so much, could I leave my father to die now? Now, when we could have a good hot bath and lie down? "Father," I screamed. "Father, get up from here, immediately. You're killing yourself." I seized him by the arm. He continued to groan. "Don't shout, son. Take pity on your old father. Leave me to rest here, just for a bit. I'm so tired, at the end of my strength." He had become like a child, weak, timid, vulnerable. "Father," I said, "you can't stay here." I showed him the corpses all around him. They too had wanted to rest here. "I can see them, son. I can see them all right. Let them sleep. It's so long since they closed their eyes. They are exhausted. Exhausted." His voice was tender. I yelled against the wind, "They'll never wake again. Never. Don't you understand?" For a long time this argument went on. I felt that I was not arguing with him, but with death itself, with the death that he had already chosen. The sirens began to wail, an alert.
The lights went out throughout the camp. The guards drove us toward the blocks. In a flash, there was no one left on the assembly place. We were only too glad not to have had to stay outside longer in the icy wind. We let ourselves sink down onto the planks. The beds were in several tiers. The cauldrons of soup at the entrance attracted no one. To sleep, that was all that mattered. It was daytime when I awoke. And then I remembered that I had a father. Since the alert, I had followed the crowd without troubling about him. I had known that he was at the end, on the brink of death, and yet I had abandoned him. I went to look for him. But at the same moment, this thought came into my mind. Don't let me find him. If only I could get rid of this dead weight so that I could use all my strength to struggle for my own survival and only worry about myself. Immediately, I felt ashamed of myself. Ashamed forever. I walked for hours without finding him. Then I came to the block where they were giving out black coffee. The men were lining up and fighting. A plaintive, beseeching voice caught me in the spine. Eliezer, my son, bring me a drop of coffee. I ran to him. Father, I've been looking for you for so long. Where were you? Did you sleep? How do you feel? He was burning with fever. Like a wild beast, I cleared a way for myself to the coffee cauldron, and I managed to carry back a cupful. I had a sip, the rest was for him. I can't forget the light of thankfulness in his eyes while he gulped it down. An animal gratitude. With those few gulps of hot water, I probably brought him more satisfaction than I had done during my whole childhood. He was lying on a plank, livid, his lips pale and dried up, shaken by tremors. I could not stay by him for long. Orders had been given to clear the place for cleaning. Only the sick could stay. We stayed outside for 5 hours. Soup was given out. As soon as we were allowed to go back to the blocks, I ran to my father. Have you had anything to eat? No. Why not? They didn't give us anything. They said that if we were ill, we should die soon anyway, and it would be a pity to waste the food. I can't go on anymore. I gave him what was left of my soup, but it was with a heavy heart. I felt that I was giving it up to him against my will. No better than Rabbi Eliyahu's son had I withstood the test. He grew weaker day by day, his gaze veiled, his face the color of dead leaves. On the third day after our arrival at Buchenwald, everyone had to go to the showers, even the sick who had to go through last. On the way back from the baths, we had to wait outside for a long time. They had not yet finished cleaning the blocks. Seeing my father in the distance, I ran to meet him. He went by me like a ghost, passed me without stopping, without looking at me. I called to him. He did not come back. I ran after him. Father, where are you running to? He looked at me for a moment, and his gaze was distant, visionary. It was the face of someone else. A moment only, and on he ran again. Struck down with dysentery, my father lay in his bunk, 5 other invalids with him. I sat by his side, watching him, not daring to believe that he could escape death again. Nevertheless, I did all I could to give him hope. Suddenly, he raised himself on his bunk and put his feverish lips to my ear. Eliezer, I must tell you where to find the gold and the money I buried in the cellar. You know. He began to talk faster and faster, as though he were afraid he would not have time to tell me. I tried to explain to him that this was not the end, that we would go back to the house together, but he would not listen to me. He could no longer listen to me. He was exhausted. A trickle of saliva mingled with blood was running from between his lips. He had closed his eyes. His breath was coming in gasps. For a ration of bread, I managed to change beds with a prisoner in my father's bunk. In the afternoon, the doctor came. I went and told him that my father was very ill. Bring him here. I explained that he could not stand up, but the doctor refused to listen to anything. Somehow I brought my father to him. He stared at him, then questioned him in a clipped voice. What do you want? My father's ill, I answered for him. Dysentery.
Dysentery? That's not my business. I'm a surgeon. Go on, make room for the others.
Protests did no good. I can't go on, son. Take me back to my bunk.
I took him back and helped him to lie down. He was shivering.
Try and sleep a bit, father. Try to go to sleep.
His breathing was labored, thick. He kept his eyes shut, yet I was convinced that he could see everything, that now he could see the truth in all things. Another doctor came to the block, but my father would not get up. He knew that it was useless. Besides, this doctor had only come to finish off the sick. I could hear him shouting at them that they were lazy and just wanted to stay in bed. I felt like leaping at his throat, strangling him. But I no longer had the courage or the strength. I was riveted to my father's deathbed. My hands hurt. I was clenching them so hard. Ah, to strangle the doctor and the others, to burn the whole world, my father's murderers. But the cry stayed in my throat. When I came back from the bread distribution, I found my father weeping like a child.
Son, they keep hitting me.
Who? I thought he was delirious.
Him, the Frenchman, and the Pole, they were hitting me.
Another wound to the heart. Another hate. Another reason for living lost.
Eliezer, Eliezer, tell them not to hit me. I haven't done anything. Why do they keep hitting me?
I began to abuse his neighbors. They laughed at me. I promised them bread, soup. They laughed. Then they got angry. They could not stand my father any longer, they said, because he was now unable to drag himself outside to relieve himself. The following day, he complained that they had taken his ration of bread.
While you were asleep? No, I wasn't asleep. They jumped on top of me. They snatched my bread, and they hit me again. I can't stand any more, son. A drop of water.
I knew that he must not drink, but he pleaded with me for so long that I gave in. Water was the worst poison he could have, but what else could I do for him? With water, without water, it would all be over soon anyway.
You, at least, have some mercy on me.
Have mercy on him. I, his only son. A week went by like this.
This is your father, isn't it? Asked the head of the block.
Yes, he's very ill. The doctor won't do anything for him.
The doctor can't do anything for him now, and neither can you.
He put his great hairy hand on my shoulder and added,
Listen to me, boy. Don't forget that you're in a concentration camp. Here, every man has to fight for himself and not think of anyone else, even of his father. Here, there are no fathers, no brothers, no friends. Everyone lives and dies for himself alone. I'll give you a sound piece of advice. Don't give your ration of bread and soup to your old father. There's nothing you can do for him, and you're killing yourself. Instead, you ought to be having his ration.
I listened to him without interrupting. He was right, I thought, in the most secret region of my heart. But I dared not admit it. It's too late to save your old father, I said to myself. You ought to be having two rations of bread, two rations of soup. Only a fraction of a second. But I felt guilty. I ran to find a little soup to give my father, but he did not want it. All he wanted was water.
Don't drink water. Have some soup. I'm burning. Why are you being so unkind to me, my son? Some water.
I brought him some water. Then I left the block for roll call. But I turned around and came back again. I lay down on the top bunk. Invalids were allowed to stay in the block, so I would be an invalid myself. I would not leave my father. There was silence all round now, broken only by groans. In front of the block, the SS were giving orders. An officer passed by the beds. My father begged me,
My son,
Some water. I'm burning. My stomach. Quiet over there, yelled the officer.
Eliezer,
went on my father, some water. The officer came up to him and shouted at him to be quiet. But my father did not hear him. He went on calling me. The officer dealt him a violent blow on the head with his truncheon. I did not move. I was afraid. My body was afraid of also receiving a blow. Then my father made a rattling noise, and it was my name.
Eliezer.
I could see that he was still breathing, spasmodically. I did not move. When I got down after roll call, I could see his lips trembling as he murmured something. Bending over him, I stayed gazing at him for over an hour, engraving into myself the picture of his blood-stained face, his shattered skull. Then I had to go to bed. I climbed into my bunk above my father, who was still alive. It was January 28th, 1945. I awoke on January 29th at dawn. In my father's place lay another invalid. They must have taken him away before dawn and carried him to the crematory. He may still have been breathing. There were no prayers at his grave. No candles were lit to his memory. His last word was my name, a summons to which I did not respond. I did not weep, and it pained me that I could not weep. But I had no more tears. And in the depths of my being, in the recesses of my weakened conscience, could I have searched it, I might perhaps have found something like free at last. I had to stay at Buchenwald until April 11th. I have nothing to say of my life during this period. It no longer mattered. After my father's death, nothing could touch me anymore. I was transferred to the children's block where there were 600 of us. The front was drawing nearer. I spent my days in a state of total idleness, and I had but one desire, to eat. I no longer thought of my father or of my mother. From time to time I would dream of a drop of soup, of an extra ration of soup. On April 5th, the wheel of history turned. It was late in the afternoon. We were standing in the block, waiting for an SS man to come and count us. He was late in coming. Such a delay was unknown till then in the history of Buchenwald. Something must have happened. 2 hours later, the loudspeakers sent out an order from the head of the camp. All the Jews must come to the assembly place. This was the end. Hitler was going to keep his promise. The children in our block went toward the place. There was nothing else we could do. Gustav, the head of the block, made this clear to us with his truncheon. But on the way we met some prisoners who whispered to us, "Go back to your block. The Germans are going to shoot you. Go back to your block and don't move." We went back to our block. We learned on the way that the camp resistance organization had decided not to abandon the Jews and was going to prevent their being liquidated. As it was late and there was great upheaval, innumerable Jews had passed themselves off as non-Jews, the head of the camp decided that a general roll call would take place the following day. Everybody would have to be present. The roll call took place. The head of the camp announced that Buchenwald was to be liquidated. 10 blocks of deportees would be evacuated each day. From this moment, there would be no further distribution of bread and soup. And the evacuation began. Every day, several thousand prisoners went through the camp gate and never came back. On April 10th, there were still about 20,000 of us in the camp, including several hundred children. They decided to evacuate us all at once, right on until the evening. Afterward, they were going to blow up the camp. So we were massed in the huge assembly square in rows of five, waiting to see the gate open. Suddenly, the sirens began to wail, an alert. We went back to the blocks. It was too late to evacuate us that evening. The evacuation was postponed again to the following day. We were tormented with hunger. We had eaten nothing for 6 days except a bit of grass or some potato peelings found near the kitchens. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the SS scattered through the camp, moving the last victims toward the assembly place. Then the resistance movement decided to act. Armed men suddenly rose up everywhere. Bursts of firing, grenades exploding. We children stayed flat on the ground in the block. The battle did not last long. Toward noon, everything was quiet again. The SS had fled, and the resistance had taken charge of the running of the camp. At about 6 o'clock in the evening, the first American tank stood at the gates of Buchenwald. Our first act as free men was to throw ourselves onto the provisions. We thought only of that, not of revenge, not of our families. Nothing but bread. And even when we were no longer hungry, there was still no one who thought of revenge. On the following day, some of the young men went to Weimar to get some potatoes and clothes, and to sleep with girls. But of revenge, not a sign. 3 days after the liberation of Buchenwald, I became very ill with food poisoning. I was transferred to the hospital and spent 2 weeks between life and death. One day I was able to get up after gathering all my strength. I wanted to see myself in the mirror hanging on the opposite wall. I had not seen myself since the ghetto. From the depths of the mirror, a corpse gazed back at me. The look in his eyes, as they stared into mine, has never left me.
The End. You've been listening to Night by Elie Wiesel, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Hitler and the Holocaust by Robert S. Wistrich, also narrated by George Guidel, and Destined to Witness by Hans J. Massaquoi, narrated by Peter J. Fernandez. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.